And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And I'm here around the table with the Pop Culture Happy Hour staff. Glenn Weldon, what do you do for NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And froggy-voiced Trey Graham with a little bit of a cold in his nose.
I do have a little bit of a cold in my
nose. What do you do for NPR, Trey?
When I'm not imitating Lauren Bacall, I am the movies editor at NPR.org.
And Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
Well, when I'm not wrapping up a four-day, 2,000-mile road trip, I am an editor and writer for NPR Music.
Fantastic. I did want to do one brief piece of business, which is that I hope that you all saw this week that we have been forced to change the name of the show to Super Happy Monkey Time.
Darn
after,
Skippy.
I heard from one of our listeners that some of her friends have trouble remembering the name of the show. She told us some of the alternatives that they use, and my personal favorite was Super Happy Monkey Time. So,
well, I think we have a clean break. We've done 1 year exactly.
That's right.
Of Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Right.
And from here on out, henceforth,
Super Happy
we shall be known as Super Happy Monkey Time.
Super Happy Monkey Time.
Not really.
Super Happy Monkey. Super Happy Monkey.
Super Happy Monkey Time. Super Happy Monkey Time. Anyway.
It is mere moments before someone mixes that against a beat sends it into
us. I apologize in advance.
At any rate, as Stephen mentioned, it is the first birthday of Pop Culture Happy Hour. Our first episode.
It's our big day.
That's
right.
True. Our first episode posted on July 16th of last year, which will be the day after this episode goes up.
And I have to say, I've never seen a more awkward looking baby.
Yeah.
That's true.
Well, we are, you know, we're now using pincer grasp and we're able to cooperate when you dress us.
It is a pale, freckled infant.
We're very
mewling and puking.
We're very nearly verbal.
We still have no object permanence, though.
No.
So, you know, in recognition of our first anniversary birthday, we thought that we would do an appreciation-themed show, which I realize we often do.
Now, it should be noted that when we say appreciation, this is not an appreciation show like an appreciation of ourselves.
Oh, no.
This is not, let's take a look back at a year of laughter.
Please don't spike the podcast yet.
No, not
Here's
at all.
Clips of us talking.
Alternatively,
which
however.
You've already heard.
We promise none of that.
Alternatively, however, I would like to announce that July 16th, from here on out, new holiday.
New holiday.
Super Happy Monkey Day.
No, not Super Happy Monkey Day. Appreciation Day. I'm going to try to start a Twitter meme.
You're in charge.
That's going to be the beginning of what I hope will eventually be a federal paid holiday. We're going to scrap President's
Day. Saturday, Stephen, if you're going to try for a holiday.
Yeah. Well, it's not going to happen the first year. Eventually, we will be rid of either President's Day and or Columbus Day, both of which can cram it. Those are both like, why is the bank closed day? And so we're going to replace one of them with Appreciation Day, which is the day in which, well, in this case, use social media. It'll fan out from there.
Stephen Thompson, you're a mere shill and a front for the greeting card companies.
No, it is not.
It's the opposite of
it
that.
It is the opposite of for the greeting card companies. It is using free social media to tell everyone you like that you like them and why. So you want to say the most truthful thing you can say about somebody in a positive sense, using the Twitter at reply, nice thing, hashtag appreciation day, new holiday, mark it down. I will be on Twitter on and off all day Saturday, July 16th.
On the first annual appreciation
day. The first ever appreciation day, saying nice things. And as a matter of fact, I may be saying nice things to the people in this room. Oh.
And if you miss appreciation day on Saturday, it will actually roll out across appreciation week. So if you miss Saturday and you still want to get in on the appreciation
day.
Stephen is trying to shoot his own holiday in the foot. If you are hearing this and Appreciation Day has already passed, please feel free to make your own Appreciation Day anytime during Appreciation Week, I feel.
There is never a wrong day to say nice things.
That's exactly right.
Appreciation Day, parentheses, observed.
There you go.
That's true. All right, so for our appreciation-themed episode, our first topic is something that we're calling Right Place at the Right Time. And we were talking in preparation for this episode about pieces of culture, pop or otherwise, that come into your life or appear or play on the radio or show up on your TV at exactly the right place and time in your life for them to do you the most good. So start it off for us, Trey Graham.
I know we said no self-referential, no self-congratulatory, no nothing, so I'm going to try to steer very clear of this, but I do want to say that one of the three things that that came along in the right place in the right time for me was this podcast. We have all of us talked at our real life post happy hours about what a fun outlet it has been for us. And for me, at least, the invitation to participate in this thing came along at a point where I was looking for something new and different to do. So that's been great. That's all I have to say about it. Contact lenses. Contact lenses came along. My parents decided they were worth the money and the trouble around about the time I was a junior in high school. I think it was around the time I started to grow into what meager looks I have. I am not.
Trey is an Adonis.
Oh, please.
What are you talking about?
I would not go so far as to say that my senior high school picture will make anybody swoon. Because, frankly, there's still a little bit more hair in that picture than I'm entirely comfortable thinking about, but it was the 1980s. The bigger point is that for the first time in my young life, I was not four eyes, and that involved a change in my confidence level that, together with a lot of other things that kind of came into focus at the same time, it marked a real turning point
for me. So to
speak. If I ever get rid of my glasses, I'm confident that I will become a confident person.
Yes. Thirdly and lastly, the two-step. I know that you all like to laugh when I talk about country western dancing, and I know that I have talked a little bit
before. It's the mental image, Trey.
I know, in a joking way, about the odd sort of collection of things that add up to me.
The mental image comes up way too easily.
In my mind, it's always boot scoot and boogie.
I would understand that, and I would certainly understand if you were to scoff a little bit at the fact that I have been known to dance a line dance called the Mambo Shuffle to the extended club remix of Madonna's recording of the Andrew Lloyd Webber song "Don't Cry for Me, Argentina."
This is not to be surprised.
I was going to say this is not a shocking mental image. I just see it completely.
It's in focus in my mind at the moment.
He's completely in focus. Are the drag queens there because they're drag queens?
they're shimmying.
Are happening there. In all seriousness, the line dances are fun and silly, but they are just one thing. I had never been a partner dancing type until I started going to the country western gay bar on Capitol Hill, in the shadow of the United States Capitol. And shortly after that, I started going to the annual, you know, gigantic harvest moon ball that they stage in conjunction with the annual gay rodeo. And this happened at a time in my life that was kind of analogous to the times that the contact lenses in the podcast came along. I was looking for other ways to connect with people, other ways to get out of my shell a little bit, and it turned out that I was pretty good with the two-step. I met whole new communities of people, and I lost a little weight, and I reconnected with a whole range of music that had kind of been important to, a little bit to me, but mostly to other people in my life, my family, when I was a kid. But, you know, this was a music that, for a while, I had kind of dismissed as kind of infra-dig. I mean, this was 10 or 15 years ago, but the lesson has since served me well in all kinds of ways. And I think it plugs in very closely with the whole philosophy of this podcast and the blog that it's connected to. And that is the idea that something doesn't have to be quote-unquote sophisticated, however you define that or however you allow somebody else to define it for you, to bring you a great deal of joy.
That's excellent.
Wow, that's
what I got.
Really well
nicely said.
Fantastic, nicely said. All right, Stephen Thompson. Right place at the right time.
Well, in the interest of speeding things along, I will cross gay rodeo off of my appreciation list. To piggyback on what Trey was saying, not about the gay rodeo, but about this podcast, I really, honest to God, we are not soliciting praise. That is not what Appreciation Day, the founder's intent is not that we are soliciting praise. But personally and professionally, this podcast could not have come at a better time for me as well, which is one reason we started doing it, and will not go without saying how much I appreciate everyone involved. Two things that I would bring up as actual pop culture appreciations. One is fairly obvious, and that is The Simpsons. Mm-hmm. Oh man, having that show come along when I'm 17 years old and just starting to find the confidence that fully allowed me to talk to other people. Having that show come along and give me this huge vocabulary refresher.
A common vocabulary.
Yeah. There's absolutely endless, endless, endless inside jokes that, again, were in my personal life, but also in the life that I would share with strangers. You know, you had this common bonding with like-minded, not only nerds. Everybody watched The Simpsons when it first came out. And man, that show, there's this wonderful line in a wonderful episode of that show where the lead in to worst episode ever, where, you know, they're kind of playing off the criticisms of the show. And Bart Simpson says to the comic book store guy, "They've given you thousands of hours of entertainment for free. If anything, you owe them." I absolutely feel that way about that show. Mm-hmm. That show has had good years. It's had mediocre years. It has had some of the best years of any television show ever. And one of the greatest opportunities that I've had as a geek was getting to meet Matt Groening at a comedy festival like 12 years ago and just sit down and just briefly, slavishly thank him. Mm-hmm. Because that guy, that creation, absolutely made my life so much better.
One of the remarkable things about The Simpsons is that it achieved very quickly cultural saturation. Eat My Shorts, do the Bartman, and that's the point when most shows die.
Right.
But yeah, that's true.
It plowed on. It continued on, and it just sort of ignored that you couldn't get away from it. And it still is, I mean, it's kept being good for a good long time.
See also South Park.
Right.
For that. You know, for a show that crossed over into, you know, Cartman peeing on the Ford logo on the decal on the back of the truck. You know, but is still a very sharp, very pungent show. Mm-hmm. The other one that I would add is the HBO comedy series Mr. Show, you know, which was kind of coming up as The Onion was coming up, and I was working at The Onion. And actually, I got to do 5 interviews with Bob Odenkirk and David Cross as they're starting the project, as the project is getting off the ground, as the project crashes and burns, as the project is about to make a movie, as the movie crashes and burns. And so I had this incredible snapshot of the creative process from outside, which is actually documented in the AV Club book, The Tenacity of the Cockroach, which I edited.
Very good. Very good. You should read it, and I'm not just saying that.
That show really came along at the right time. And that is a show that I'm surprised how many even fairly comedy-adjacent people are not as up on that show as I would recommend being Mr. Show. The entire show is on DVD. It's probably on Netflix. It was on HBO for 30 episodes and is absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. The Simpsons, Mr. Show.
Okay, I had 2 Right Place at the Right Time entries. One involves the fact that when I was 13 years old, I went off to music camp. They had chorus, choir. There were musicals to be in, which I was in. That's when I was in Pippin. Don't ask me about being in Pippin. Anyway.
That's not at all why you brought it up.
So I did a bunch of great stuff there that I really enjoyed. And it's where I learned to, you know, sing in Italian and other cool things that I would not have anticipated I would ever learn to do. But one of the things we did, the chorus teacher there, who was a terrific lady named Neonu Span Wilson, believed very strongly that when you're teaching kids choral singing, they should learn to read music, but that they should also have the ability to learn by ear. And just by having you play the part for them, and then they learn it that way. So the thing that we learned by ear, one of the years that I was there, maybe the last of the 4 summers that I was there, I went there 4 summers, was I sing The Body Electric, which is from Fame. And it's kind of a corny idea, but she was very smart and that she recognized that these were all a bunch of, you know, young creative nerd types. And the song is very much written from the standpoint of young creative nerd types. And even though it's a cornball of a song, boy, did we love it. That was certainly the period of time when I first staked my claim to the idea that I'm going to be someone who's going to hang around with creative oddball nerds. And, you know, not regular school nerds, but sort of arts nerds. It was through, actually, people I knew at music camp that I connected with Oberlin, and kind of everything in my life has sort of followed down that track. So
Fame.
So absolutely.
That's the trigger.
It sounds completely...
Everything good that has ever happened to you.
It sounds completely ridiculous, but it was actually a big moment. All of us together at that camp in that place learning that particular song, which is so much like an anthem of young creative people. It was actually quite significant. The other one...
Do you suppose Glee is like that for young people today?
It may be. Yeah. Although, I think
there's some anecdotal evidence that it has been.
Right.
I would think being an artsy kid coming up and suddenly there's this whole...
Right.
Yeah.
There's this phenomenon that sort of validates the performing geek that you are. There's a really interesting essay by Hank Stuever, who writes for the Washington Post. That was published in The Stranger in Seattle. Look it up. It sort of argues that the show is destructive in that way. I'm not sure I buy all of its premises, but it's a really fascinating argument. I won't go into it here because
we'll
short on time.
We'll
but
find
it's
a
good.
Link
to it.
The other thing that I would mention very quickly in passing is a Martha Wainwright song called Don't Forget, which is very sad but also very warm and entered my life in kind of a complex fashion at which point sometimes exactly the thing you need is the exact right sad connecting thing that sort of snuggles up to your inner sad person. Just kind of is just exactly the right kind of sighing, sad song with just the right associations at the right moment. But there are no headless scars for the heart. Just a cold wind that leaves its frosted mind. Don't forget that I will always love you. Just a reminder to help you pave your pathway. The fall it cools, in the winter it snows, spring it rains, summer comes and you go.
Sort of validates the feeling and reminds you that you can, you know, probably get past it.
Yeah,
right?
And it kind of, it's a sort of a healthy wallowing. Yep. And that particular song is very good for that. It's, again, Martha Wainwright off her album of the same name, Martha Wainwright, and the song is Don't Forget, and I loved that very much. Glenn Weldon, right place at the right time.
Right place, right time. Since I was 14, up till I took the day job that I have now, I have worked in bookstores, and I think there is no better place for a young person who wants to be a writer to spend their time. I don't know if it's what writers are going to do now that there are no more bookstores and we're in the age of Amazon and ebooks, but I think writers harbor a lot of really romantic notions about writing and about getting published in particular. And man, there is nothing that will disabuse you of your precious little conceptions like spending your days neck deep in the marketplace.
Yeah.
Because you see piles of books come into the store through the loading dock every day and trickle out the front door. Mm. It's the same five or six books that keep trickling out the front door. You realize getting published is step one.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
So much other stuff has to happen. Everything has to go right. But you also, and I think this is very important, you see who is buying what. You see the audience. I think that's incredibly important. I always found it really inspiring to go over to the wall, in my case, the wall of fiction. And I think every writer does this. And find the spot on the wall where my novel will be, right there. You find that little spot. In my case, it was right after Faye Weldon, no relation, and right before Irvine Welsh.
Yes.
And I still do this. I still go into bookstores to do this. Now, you guys both have books, Linda and Steven, so you probably don't need to do that.
Mine is not in any bookstores anymore, which is sort of a blessing to us all.
I, for a long time, would go and just look for my book and then weep softly when
there
it wasn't there.
Trey, have you ever done that?
I have not.
Okay. So anyway, I go away to...
Oh, wait, that's a total lie.
Of course.
I contributed a couple of essays to a book that was published once upon a time about sort of interesting people, people who'd been influential in the gay rights movement in the first sort of 20 years of SAME. And yeah, I suppose there was probably a time when I went into the bookstore and looked for it and, you know, looked at the pages with my essays on them.
There you go.
Yeah, to this day, whenever I'm in the bookstore with the kids, I try to find a book with my name in it.
Yeah. So I go away to the fancy schmancy, if wildly impractical, MFA program to get an MFA in fiction. And then I get a job teaching writing, which paid nothing. So I needed to supplement that income. And I, you know, I'd come to a few conclusions about myself there in the prairie of Iowa. So I decided I'm not just going to work in a bookstore. I'm going to work in the big gay bookstore. And here was my thought process. It's going to be like working in every other bookstore I've ever worked in, except there will also be safe and nurturing and positive and community. I don't know what the hell I was thinking.
All
whatever.
These things you once believed in.
See, here's the thing. I know the bookstore he's talking about, and nothing could be further from
I
what
get
he's
so
just
excited because I think I'm going to run the book discussion group. I'll make shelf tags, because I was, in every bookstore I've ever worked in, I was funny shelf tag guy.
I'll bet you
yeah,
were.
I was known for the funny shelf tag.
Oh,
that was my little fiefdom.
Gosh.
Sad and pathetic. So, I think I'll get to recommend books. When's the last time I recommended a book to somebody? I love recommending books. And I realized, well, I haven't read a lot of this gay fiction, so I should probably, you know, start cracking some books so I can recommend something. And
yeah, and
that's
you did.
When I noticed that every book in this store, not just the porn, but the fiction, the nonfiction, somehow managed to get a naked male torso on every cover. So we're not going to buy a book unless it has nipples. Great. This says wonderful things about my people. It got to be a game. Like, how many ways are there to put a naked male torso in a book? Well, a tremendous lot, it turns out.
Yes.
A tremendous lot. I realized when I was there 2 weeks that not only had I not recommended a book to anybody because nobody had come up to me to ask for a book, I had not sold a single book in 2 weeks. Because
not working on commission, I hope.
The three pillars of this particular gay bookstore, and I don't know if it's true for all, it's probably true for all the gay bookstores, is lube, porn, rainbow flag bumper stickers. You take away any one of those. And I was growing increasingly dispirited and just disappointed and deeply embittered as I stayed there. So this book comes in. Mark Merlis is the author.
Oh, yeah.
The name of the book is An Arrow's Flight. And I had not read his first book, his torso on the cover. So I start the flyleaf, and it's a novel set in the last days of the Trojan War, from the point of view of Pyrrhus, son of Achilles. I was like, all right, so paragraph one of the flyleaf, not bad. Get to the second one. The twist, the wacky little twist, it takes place also in the modern age, where Pyrrhus is a go-go boy / male prostitute. So I am on second paragraph of the flyleaf, and I'm already like, oh boy, here we go. What am I going to do here? So I read it. I am 2 pages into this book when it changes my life. This book is so hugely imaginative, and it takes real narrative risks. For him to be able to do that 2-timeline thing that he's doing, mm-hmm. he has to do a lot of work that we, the reader, don't see. Mm. And he has to make it seem effortless, and he does. It's a very funny, smart book about things like sex, about class, about the kind of hierarchy of physical attractiveness that exists in the gay culture. And it, just line by line, it's lovely. So it would be hyperbolic of me to say that it restored my faith in my people. But it kind of restored my faith in my people. Uh-huh. Yes, we do exploitative crap, but we also produce art.
Yes.
Really solid, a great book.
Without nipples.
I will say, my people are the same way, but without the art.
Yeah. Anyway, An Arrow's Flight by Mark Merlis.
Very good. All right. Well, now you know some of the stuff that we have come across at the best possible moment. And now we're going to touch on a topic that is the bad timing equivalent of that good timing topic, which we're calling Wish You Were Here. And one of the things that we got talking about with appreciation is that every now and then there are people who, either because they have died or because they have stopped doing whatever it is that they once did that you loved, are no longer available to provide the wonderful art and writing and commentary and whatever that you perhaps love from them. So Glenn Weldon, Wish You Were Here.
2 comics. One called Thor the Mighty Avenger, which I wrote about on the blog a while back. It only lasted 8 issues despite my talking it up, which just goes to show that my ones of readers did not respond. It was written by Roger Langridge with art. This amazing, colorful, bold art by Chris Samney. It's called an all-ages book, which makes you think that it's a kid's book. It's not. It's a kid-friendly book, certainly. Mm-hmm. But what it had in just those 8 issues was something that has been leaching out of comics for some time, which is whimsy. Mm. Fun.
You know what's really funny is I remember that book and I remember looking at that art because I remember you talking about the art and I remember going back and looking at the art that was in the post and thinking it was really impressive and cool. That Samney art that you're talking about.
It's just amazing. So there are 2 trade paperbacks, 4 issues each out there. So there are 1 million Thor books out there. So the book you want to look for in this case to hear what we're talking about is Thor the Mighty Avenger. A much different comic which had a much longer run but did end, I think, too soon was a book called Gotham Central. It was written by Ed Brubaker and Greg Rucka with art initially by a guy named Michael Lark. It didn't end because of lack of sales. It ended because one of the creators moved on. It's from the point of view of the Gotham City Police Department, the officers and detectives of the Major Crimes Unit, which means they have to deal with cleaning up all the stuff that these evil psychopathic supervillains mm-hmm. do. And they're also kind of dealing tangentially with Batman and his ilk. But the thing about it is that those costumed characters exist only at the periphery of this book. This book is really a procedural about dealing with the aftermath of a crazy, wacky crime. The look of it is what really sold it for me because it's Michael Lark's art is very sketchy, very dark. There's a lot of browns and grays in this book. And his panels are in a very regular grid, but they're against a black backdrop, which gives the whole book a very noir, palpable, gritty feel mm-hmm. that just works really great. So that's another book. There are 40 issues and I think 5 or 6 different trade paperbacks. Gotham Central, great book.
So 2 comics that you miss.
Yeah.
All right. Trey Graham, wish you were here.
My thought process on this took me down the road of people, not things.
Yeah, me too.
But, right. I think both are valid.
There were a lot of people.
But when you think about it, Glenn sort of values comic books more than people.
Of course. That? As we have discussed often. And I think that's fine. I think that's delightful. There were a bunch of people that I sort of nominated for this. And I don't know why I was drawn to the one I was drawn to. And I think maybe it's a theater thing. Maybe it's a musical thing. But Jerry Orbach is who I missed.
Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah.
We did a passing reference to him last week, I think. And maybe that's what made him sort of pop up in my head. But you know, he died back in 2004 after a prostate cancer diagnosis about 10 years before. And I think most people know him from Law and Order, right? And maybe from his film roles.
Beauty and the Beast.
Beauty and the Beast, but, you know, only if you think to ask who's voicing that candlestick, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
And I don't know, how many people do that.
It's Jerry Orbach.
It's Jerry Orbach, by the way. Be our guest. Yeah. Be our guest. I sort of know him because, not because I was there, but from reading about the history of the American musical theater. He was not a small musical theater star.
No.
He was a gigantic musical theater star, and I don't think people don't know that about him. He was the original El Gallo, which is the showy role
in the Fantastics,
right? Mm-hmm. If you've ever seen a production of the Fantastics in some little half-assed production somewhere, and you think, wow, that guy, this might be good if this were rock solid. Well, Jerry Orbach was rock solid.
Yeah.
He was the guy who made that show work.
I have a sort of a multi-disc Broadway collection that I got from a dear friend as a gift, a good gift for me. Mm. And one of the things it has on it is Jerry Orbach singing Try to Remember in the Fantastics. And one of the things that's so cool about it is that it sounds completely different. He has a lovely, lovely voice, but it still sounds like Jerry Orbach.
Try to remember the kind of September when life was slow and oh so mellow. Try to remember the kind of September when grass was green and grain was yellow. Try to remember the kind of September when you were a tender and callow fellow. Try to remember, and if you remember, then follow.
And if you know it's him, you listen and you think, that is Lenny Briscoe. And it's like, there's just enough of Jerry Orbach in it that you think, wow, this is Lenny Briscoe breaking into song. And yet it's this beautiful thing. It's not one of those where it's kind of unrecognizable from what you know of him, if you know him from other things.
Right.
But it's much richer and a very different angle. Yeah. I'm really glad you...
It's not the only sort of landmark show he was in. He was in a bunch of... He was in 42nd Street. He was in... he played Mac the Knife opposite Lotte Lenya.
Mm-hmm.
In a Broadway revival of Three Penny Opera back in the day. Not the original Broadway production, of course, because I was back in the 30s. But Jerry Orbach. He died. He was 69 when he died. And, there could have been a lot more Jerry Orbach.
You know, even if you do think in terms of Law and Order, I think of all the people on Law and Order, he was the one whose spot they had the hardest time filling with anybody else who did it as well. I mean, he wasn't there at the very beginning. He came in a little bit later after a couple seasons. But to me, he's kind of the biggest. If I turn an episode of that show on, which my TiVo picks them up all the time, if I turn one on and the cops at the beginning do not include Jerry Orbach, I probably won't watch it. But if they do, I probably will watch it. That's the single biggest factor in whether or not it's probably from one of the seasons that I will enjoy watching.
Yeah.
So, great pick.
Thank you.
Yeah, great,
that's
great
a terrific
pick.
One.
Stephen Thompson, wish you were here.
Oh, man, where to go with this? I've got a whole list here.
There's one that I skipped because I'm pretty sure it'll be on yours, but we'll see.
I think you're probably referring to, what, Jeff Buckley?
Yes.
Okay. Mm. Love Jeff Buckley's music. Wish there were more of it. Just an unspeakable musical tragedy. Would have been fascinating to see where he would have gone. To follow in the Glenn line of things, obviously Calvin and Hobbes. Mm-hmm. Would have loved to have seen that carry on. I love and hate the fact that strip is sort of frozen in amber and that you know, new generations can still discover it, but it's not still being refreshed. Bloom County, that comic strip was just huge for me as a budding nerd.
But take comfort, Thompson. You still have Hager the Horrible.
I do.
Fred Bassett.
Absolutely. Mary Worth, where would I be without your sage wisdom?
Mallard Fillmore.
Mallard Fillmore. Oh, Funky Winkerbean.
Andy Capp. We're just going to keep doing it.
this is
high and low.
Family circus.
It's being funny.
just keep doing it.
Family, sir.
It is just appalling to think about the fact that George Carlin is not alive to be on Twitter.
Mm. Oh, my God. Aww. Can you imagine?
Can you imagine how many more followers he would have than everybody else?
Yeah. <That's true. laughs>
If there was ever an entertainer who was just made for... just made for Twitter, mm-hmm. and dearly missed. And of course, the one that I ultimately fixated on is Jim Henson, mm-hmm. in part because, you know, my kids are still in the process of completely freaking out and being totally and utterly in love with The Muppet Show, in part because there's a new Muppet movie coming out, and mm-hmm. I've just never gotten used to Brian Henson's Kermit. Mm-hmm. But also, getting back to the theme of the episode, for me, as a hardcore devotee of all sorts of popular culture, it's very important for me to be able to thank the people who gave me the entertainment that I've loved. It's why it was so incredibly important to meet Matt Groening and slobber all over him. Even though I'm sure it wasn't important to him and might have even been a bit of a nuisance, there's still this sense of sort of wanting to give thanks to the people who have made your life better. And I would have loved to have the opportunity to thank Jim Henson, and he died in 1988, and I never got to do it.
Mm, good list. It's interesting when you bring up the comics that sort of retired voluntarily, like Calvin and Hobbes in Bloom County. And it's interesting because I definitely share the regret about both of those things being over. But then you have that moment where you think, like, on the other hand, you want people who create things to stop doing them when they stop wanting to do them.
Yes.
So that they do not fall into disrepair or obvious kind of being half-assed in the way they're being done.
Garfield.
So, I was just going to say, the fact that Jim Davis doesn't even know how to draw Garfield anymore.
Because you have those things where it's like, oh, I'm sad this person stopped doing this. But at the same time, you know, you don't necessarily want them to keep doing them indefinitely.
Yeah, you don't want them to hack it out. And in both those cases, those were like the least hacky strips ever.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so they needed to have inspiration behind them. And so right. I guess in a sense, it is nice that they exist as sort of finite collections that mm-hmm. you can devour in their entirety, but it still makes me sad.
Yeah.
It's certainly been devastating to the American comics page.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. Mm. I think that's very true. If we are on the topic of things, I have mentioned before many times.
Also stuff.
If we are on the topic of things and stuff, I have mentioned before many times my love of Sports Night, which only ran for two seasons.
Oh, Sports Night.
Which, to me, there were a million unexplored aspects of that show. And although in the second of its two seasons, it had a couple of missteps, but they had the best storyline I've ever seen on television about a sort of a depression incident and a very, very slow development of a story about someone who clearly was depressed or troubled. And it came to you gradually. And when you went back and watched the episodes, you see more of it coming. But at the time, it wasn't super obvious until all of a sudden it just kind of happened. And then you felt like, yeah, you know, there's been a lot going on for quite a while with that guy. And then you kind of get it. So definitely, I felt like there was a lot more to explore. And I feel like it's a show that was just on a little bit too soon. They were really on that cusp between comedies that did and didn't have laugh tracks and more traditional comedic setup punch structure. But, you know, fantastic and short-lived, and that makes me sad. One of the things on my list is Jim Henson. Ah. So I will throw in with Stephen, partly because I just saw Being Elmo recently, which is the documentary about Kevin Clash, who does Elmo. And I think when I looked at Jim Henson in that documentary, what you keep thinking about is, like, there was so much obvious, evident warmth and love for everything that they did. And although the people in that organization, I think, have continued to work very hard and are still very dedicated people,
passionate,
and have done a lot of terrific, wonderful things. And Kevin Clash is, like, if you see that guy, he's just instantaneously so charming that even if you don't like Elmo, he's such a terrifically endearing, engaging person. But I think there's just this kind of blow that happens when, you know, kind of your big dude sort of is taken out of the picture. I don't think they've ever quite been able to recover. And obviously, every time I go back and watch the Muppet movie, the first Muppet movie, I just think it's so rare for something that you already know really well, especially as a kid's show, to be like, oh, they're going to go make a movie. And it's going to be really, really good and really inventive and funny and have some terrific songs in it. And it's like, that just so rarely happens anymore. It's like when you hear about the Smurfs, it's like, oh, the Muppet movie was essentially the version at the time of very much what's happening with the Smurfs. It was, here's this kid's property that everybody loves. Let's make a feature film. And because they were who they were.
Right.
It was this remarkable feature film.
It wasn't taken out of their hands.
Which I think is a fantastic movie that I can enjoy as an adult, that I loved as a kid. My sister and I wore the record out listening to it.
There's something really profound about his connection to those characters. And it's to hear you talk about it this way reminds me, I talked the other week about a book about the making of Follies. And the guy who wrote that is a guy named Ted Chapin, who in the introduction to the book talks about his experience at the O'Neill Theater Center in Connecticut, which is a sort of annual summer play development thing. They also have a puppetry workshop. So one day a week they would learn about the arts of theatrical puppetry. And people apparently were dubious about this and sort of, you know, suspicious of how much it worked. And I want to read you the passage from this book where he sort of describes an epiphany. He says, "Friday afternoons were set aside for puppetry since Margot and Rufus Rose, the creators of Howdy Doody, lived nearby. For them, we suffered through a series of visiting puppeteers who attempted to teach us what one referred to as the most basic of all art forms, because there is nothing between the creator and his art. We were, however, won over on the day a gangly, soft-spoken Jim Henson arrived with a duffel bag full of his creations for a new children's television show that had just gone on the air. He told us simply, 'These are my friends.' That guy's reach much further than mainstream pop culture. He inspired a whole generation of people doing theatrical puppetry, and it's worth remembering.
You know, one of the things that's great about being Elmo, you figure out that puppetry is a genuinely unique art in the sense that they are involved in both building, especially ones who are up and coming and don't have, for example, the Jim Henson Workshop working for them. You know, when Kevin Clash was young and was interested in puppetry and puppets, he built his own stuff. They're building the puppet. They're building the characters. And one of the reasons why he wanted so badly to connect with the people that worked with Jim Henson was not just, I'm going to learn from them about the wonder of Jim Henson. He wanted to learn stuff like, what do you make the puppets out of so that the seams don't show? And, you know, what are the materials that you perhaps have access to that I don't have access to? So it has this wonderfully interesting mechanical element that is very different from what anybody else does, this building and construction element that makes it a genuinely unique kind of thing. So the other person that I thought of was River Phoenix. And the reason I thought of River Phoenix is that I still believe that you can see performances early in the career of that kid that indicate that he already was well positioned to be a fantastic actor. And I'm very sad about the opportunities lost and things like that. So him too.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, fortunately, having wrapped up our Wish You Were Here, we are on to a happier topic, the happiest of topics.
Super Happy Monkey Time.
Specifically, Super Happy Monkey Time is moving on to what is making us monkey happy this week. Happy, like happier than a barrel of monkeys, as they say. Glenn Weldon, what is making you monkey happy this week?
Well, it's a tall order, but live up to it. It's a 10-year anniversary of a film called Wet Hot Americans.
Oh, yes, it is.
Indeed.
And right now, the air in Washington, D.C. is broth. So this is the perfect time of year to revisit it. This is a film that no matter how many times I go back to it, I always find something new that is my favorite thing about this freaking movie.
Mm. Yes.
Right now, it is the training montage between Christopher Maloney and Michael Showalter. There are expressions on Christopher Maloney's face that just... there's nothing better.
And we should explain this is a summer camp comedy.
Sure. In the vein of Meatballs. It's not mere parody. It's got its own distinct sensibility. But, I mean, the cast of this thing is just a nursery of incredible comic talent. Amy Poehler, Janine Garofalo, Michael Showalter, Michael Ian Black, David Hyde Pierce, Christopher Maloney, Paul Rudd, Ken Marino, Elizabeth Banks, Joe DiTrullio, 80 Miles, Bradley Cooper, fetal Bradley Cooper.
Fetal Bradley Cooper with a scene in the woodshed.
And Molly Shannon, it's just fantastic. So if you haven't seen it in a while, just go back. It's great.
I 100% agree. Wet Hot American Summer is one that I did not know until sort of a couple years ago when I had a bunch of friends who were really super into it, and I kind of sat down and watched it. And it is odd, but it is great.
It's an odd but a cult favorite.
It's from that whole, you know, David Wayne, Thomas Lennon kind of, there are these kind of comedy pods, and it's sort of that comedy pod crossed with a bunch of other ones. People who came from, you know, what became other comedy pods.
Yep.
You know, Amy Poehler, who obviously was kind of on the UCB side, and, you know, Paul Rudd, who sort of became partly in that pod and partly in the Apatow pod, and, yep. you know, it's...
And because it's got a very distinct comic sensibility, I've talked to people, smart people, getters of it, who say that they didn't get it the first time they saw it, mm-hmm. but the second time. Once that you know what the tone is, it's now their
favorite. I could be mistaken, but I believe at the AV Club we were sort of... very lukewarm on it when it first came out. Yeah.
So you're saying it takes a second viewing, much like Big Trouble in Little China.
Well, no. That doesn't benefit.
Sorry, inside joke, everybody.
Well, Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week? Is it the fact that you got to see Big Trouble in Little China
on a
rooftop, much as we saw Gymkhana last summer?
That was a happy-making evening, I have to say, yes. That was fun. But that is not what's making me happy this week. What's making me happy this week is tonic water.
Good Lord.
I feel... Bear with me. I feel
tonic water and wet wipes? Will the excitement never end?
Stop overstimulating. Hold on. What about product increments?
Yes.
Jeez,
well,
there's
that
an
too.
Entire aisle that of the too. Safeway that you feel.
No. No, I feel like I've had a breakthrough moment because I feel like I'm closer today.
Was it at the
today.
CVS?
It was not. I feel like I'm closer today to Glenn Weldon and his colonialist forebears because while I have never been a fan of gin, and frankly, I'm still not, I have definitely never been a fan of tonic. Because tonic water, let us be honest, tastes like armpits.
Oh, no.
Except that this weekend, I was at a birthday party where the host, who also brews and bottles his own craft beer, his own tonic water. It looked
Made his own tonic water. Was it served on a yacht by any chance?
There's not a fancy party. It was just party. It looked like Planter's Punch. It was kind of pinkish brown and fizzy. And it tasted nothing at all like Right Guard. In fact, it tasted like ginger and tropical sunlight. And I liked it so much that eventually I had a glass of it without the gin. Although not right away.
You had a glass of tonic water.
I had a glass of tonic water over ice with a lime.
Were you drunk already by any chance when you...
Well, I might have been needing to alternate.
Yes. Mm-hmm, I thought
Seriously, it's awesome.
I thought perhaps...
There are recipes out there on the internet. People try
it. I'm really glad.
Apparently, it's not very hard, and it's awesome.
I consider cocktail hour a completely legitimate element of pop culture.
It
fortunately
is absolutely
for all
nothing like the tonic water you buy in the supermarket, and it even made me almost like gin.
Holy cow.
Good Lord. The devil, you say.
This is craziness.
I'm saying.
Stephen Thompson, is there any possibility that you can compete with that?
No. I was just back in Wisconsin over the weekend, and my mother purchased me a case of Spotted Cow.
Where is
which
it?
Which means that Linda's coming over.
Let's go get it right now.
Please explain for those of us who are not.
It is the absolute most delicious beer in the world, brewed by New Glarus in New Glarus, Wisconsin. Oh my God, this beer is so delicious. And you can get it even at bars that have like 40-year-old plastic signs that say Mountain Dew. Most of them will still serve you. It's like, oh, we've got Light, Miller Light, Bud Light, and Spotted Cow.
But you can't get it outside Wisconsin.
But you cannot. They do not sell it outside of Wisconsin. There was a bar in New York that was busted for illegally selling Spotted Cow.
Okay, so you have in fact violated the spirit of this segment. The thing that is making us happy should theoretically be available to
Friends custom-made tonic available?
I just said
available?
There are recipes on the internet.
Glass houses.
And anybody can buy wet wipes.
Anybody can go to Wisconsin and drink a delicious spot.
People who swim in homemade tonic water should not throw stones around. All right, Stephen, what else have you?
Two musical moments, one of which I hope will be bootlegged and circulated on the internet.
Uh-huh.
One is if you have not seen the video of Justin Vernon from Bon Iver performing I Can't Make You Love Me.
Uh-huh.
It will, not just the one on the Jimmy Fallon show, but uh-huh. there's a studio version. Uh-huh. It will rip out your beating heart, tear it into many pieces, painstakingly stitch them back together, and slide it back in.
Turn down the lights, turn down the bed, turn down these voices inside my head. Lay down with me, tell me no lies, just hold me close, don't patronize me, don't patronize.
unbelievably beautiful. It is one of my favorite singers of all time, covering one of my favorite songs of all time.
I was going to say, that's a Bonnie Raitt song.
That is Bonnie Raitt.
Hard to go bad.
Oof, boy. Yeah, it is just a... this wonderful collision of things I love.
Yeah.
Bon Iver, Bonnie Raitt.
I emphatically co-sign.
Oh, boy. Also, over the weekend, while driving to Wisconsin, stopped in Fort Wayne, Indiana, where I saw another one of my favorite singers, Yves Barzelay, perform with the Fort Wayne Philharmonic.
Oh.
Two songs that the Philharmonic had worked out arrangements for of his music. I have spoken just gassed on endlessly about how much I love Clem Snyder, how much I love Yves Barzelay. This has been an ongoing concern for more than a decade now. Hearing him perform the song Your Favorite Music, which is one of my favorite songs of all time, Your Favorite Music, Well, It Just Makes You Sad, with an orchestra sort of blooming and swelling behind him, was just an absolutely incredible experience. It would have been worth driving to Fort Wayne just to see that. And finally, what is making me happy is All People. And that is how, and I'm going to celebrate All People on Saturday, July 16th as part of Appreciation Day.
# Appreciation Day. Linda. So you're short those characters. All right. Well, what's making me happy this week? I got a little one and a big one. The little one is Matt Paxton, who is the clutter cleaner on Hoarders. Now, here's the thing about Matt Paxton. If you watch Hoarders right now, you're going like this. Oh, yeah. Matt is the coolest. Matt is one of the guys who comes in with his junk crew and helps clean out the house. I have seen Matt clean out houses full of dead animals, houses full of poo. I mean, you wouldn't think there'd be such a thing as a poo hoarder, but there are. Oh. And Matt is unfazed. You can follow him on Twitter. His Twitter name is Clutter Cleaner. The great thing about Matt is that he is able to appreciate the dark humor in these situations and to acknowledge it without that ever interfering with his compassion and kindness to the people that he's dealing with who have illnesses and problems that have put them in this position. You have to be able to have a sense of humor about it if you're going to go in to a house that's being eaten by goats. Like, literally being eaten by goats or bunnies or whatever. But it can't be mocking.
Right, it can't come out as judgment or mockery.
It has to be the same kind of sense of humor that you have to have if you're dealing with an illness or something like that, with any other kind of illness, because that's kind of what this is. And he just has a wonderful balance. And he's one of those people you see on reality television in a kind of helping profession role, mm-hmm. where you wind up thinking, I could hire that guy, like, not to clean my house, but, like, kind of just to kind of cheer me on, like, day to day, which is sort of the same way I feel about Dr. Drew. Like, I'm not an addict, so I can't really hire Dr. Drew, but if he could just talk to me.
See, I feel the same way about Shelley Sprague from that show.
Yes.
Oh, my God, do I love Shelley.
Shelley, for those of you who don't watch Celebrity Rehab, is one of the techs who works in the facility with Drew, and Shelley is the bomb.
Love.
So Matt Paxton, the clutter cleaner on Hoarders, is my little one. My big one is the same one that a bunch of the rest of you started off with, which is that having done this for a year, I can honestly say it is one of my favorite things I've ever done. And, you know, as Trey alluded to, I've had conversations with everyone in this room or who would normally be in this room, unfortunately. Our esteemed producer, we should mention, our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, broke his arm. Unexpectedly. And
when does one break it expectedly?
And for some reason seems to think this is an excuse to miss the podcast. So, but I've had conversations with all of our panelists and with Mike at different times about the bizarrely appropriate and helpful way in which this project came into all of our lives. And I think we have to reflect a lot of the joy of that back to those of you who have listened to it and shown your appreciation and gotten in touch with us and supported us, because, as I've mentioned before, without getting too deep into the inside the podcaster studio kind of approach, this really did start with an email between me and Steven that was like, this is what I think we should do. And
it was
I think
literally
Trey and
like,
Glenn would
it was
be
literally
on
like
it.
We should have Trey Graham and Glenn Weldon, and we'll call it Pop Culture Happy Hour.
And we'll call it Pop Culture Happy Hour, and we'll get Mike to produce it. And it is really rare in life that you get to conceive of something and then make it occur exactly the way you envisioned it, and then you really love it, and then people are really nice to you about it. Like, that's an opportunity that,
right.
You know, everybody should have at least once. And I think I have to give some props to NPR for the fact that there are not that many organizations where you could pull that off.
I think you're right, though, too, that we absolutely have to reflect, as you said, some of the most of the appreciation back to the audience. Because without that feedback, without the people saying, hey, we like this, too, it's just the four of us acting the fool in a recording studio. And
that's true. So.
Now, again, we are not... This is not fishing for praise.
We don't want to hear any more praise. We're just glad for what we've already
had. Take the praise you have within you. Go on Twitter and tweet with the hashtag Appreciation Day.
That's exactly right. Whatever appreciation you would show to us, just reflect it back out to others through Appreciation Day. The best thing you can do for Stephen, I think it's fairly clear.
Yeah, really.
The nicest thing you can do for Stephen is participate in his demented holiday that he's come up with. But I really did just want to say that, you know, having done it for a year, and the year really did fly. And I encourage all of you to go back and listen to the very first episode, if only to see how incredibly bad at this I was.
How silly we all were.
It's been wonderful, and I love you guys.
Gross. Ew, gross.
Glenn is just turned gray.
I was going to say, I'm trying to make Glenn pass out.
Yeah. The mortification is visible. Over
I'm trying to make Glenn faint. But anyway, so that's what's making me happy this week.
Absolutely.
Is wrapping up our year of our little project, our little podcast.
Here's to many more.
Here's to many more. Here's to many more. So that's the end of our podcast for today and for the year.
Yay.
You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. He loves it when you praise him and say incredibly warm things to him.
Just pay attention to him. He just loves attention.
You can follow Trey Graham at Trey Graham. That's Trey with an E, and Graham like the cracker. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, but who would dislike Stephen? You can also follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katz of K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music that you are chair dancing to right now. And once again, in the absence of Mike Katziff, we have been bailed out by our esteemed sub-producer, Jess Gittner, who you can also follow on Twitter at Jess Gittner, G-I-T-N-E-R.
We love Jess Gittner.
And of course, you should follow all of our past panelists like Tanya and Barry and Mark Hirsch. And you can find all of their info kicking around on the internet.
somewhere Bob Mondello is shouting through a megaphone.
Me too. And thanks to everybody, and thanks to you guys for being here for the last year.
Thank you.
Yay. Wouldn't miss it.
And thanks to all of you for being here, and we will see you next week.